report is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and the sovereign of the world.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 021012, City of Keller versus John W. Wilson and others from Tarrant County, the Second Court of Appeals District. 021076, Credit Watch Inc. and Harold Skip Quant versus Denise Jackson from Tarrant County in the Second Court of Appeals District. And 030784, Peter C. Browning and others versus Jeff B. Prostock and others from Dallas County and the Fifth Appellate District. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in that case. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for the first two causes and a total of 1 hour for the last argument. We expect to conclude the arguments by noon, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. The proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may purchase a cassette tape of the arguments for a nominal fee from the clerk's office. There are currently two vacancies on the court, which we hope will be filled in the near future by a gubernatorial appointment. The court is now ready to hear argument in 021012, the City of Keller versus John W. Wilson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The members of the court living in the city of Austin see every day how what used to be pastures are turned into residential subdivisions. And this case presents two questions with respect to who will pay for the consequences of that development. First, can a city ever defend an inverse condemnation lawsuit when an appellate court's evidentiary reviews of the city's intent disregards undisputed evidence showing that the city did not act with the necessary intent? Second, should an inverse condemnation suit be used as a vehicle for second-guessing a city's regulatory decision in approving development and to require the public to pay for defects in a private developer's drainage plan? Thankfully,
where are the developers? Just out of curiosity, did they settle, or did the developers settle, or what happened to the developers?
Your Honor, with respect to developers, there was a directed verdict with respect to the City of Keller's claims against the developers. The Wilson's claims against the developers were resolved on summary judgment, which the Court of Appeals affirmed.
And then they just nothing. They're not in the case anymore.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What does the record reflect about the frequency of flooding on the Wilson's property?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it shows that it occurred, that it did occur from time to time, that it occurred in association with rainfall. The testimony is not very definite, but
there's a statement, it seems like at some point, that the Wilson sites from ankle deep to waist deep. Is that at all times, sometimes?
I believe that's in association with specific rains, Your Honor. Obviously, Dr. Spindler's report is tied to certain types of rainfall. The Wilson's testimony is a little indefinite.
How many times has it flooded?
Your Honor, I don't think that I can tell you from the record how many times they said it flooded.
Is it more than once?
Yes, Your Honor.
More than three times?
Your Honor, I believe they would probably say it was more than three times.
You're not taking issue with the fact the property was damaged, are you? I mean, you're not contesting the frequency or the extent of the damage, you're just contesting the takings claim, did it?
That is correct, Your Honor. We're at the state of the record at this point, I don't believe we.
One of your arguments is that if anyone should be liable here, it should be the developers.
That is correct.
Just following up on Justice Heck's question, what relief would the Wilsons have against the developers? I understand there was a directed verdict, summary judgment. Why couldn't they collect against the developers, or did they?
They did not. My understanding, they did not collect against the developers. I don't know why they wouldn't have a cause of action against the developers, Your Honor, either under 11086 of the Water Code or under the common law flooding cause of action that appears to be created under the Kraft versus Langford case, or even sue the engineers necessarily for if they were negligent in the design of these detention ponds.
Well, I'm struggling a bit, though, on the theory that they could sue the developers, and yet they were poured out on as a matter of law on the developers. So I'm a little bit
curious
why that would be.
Sorry. I believe, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals theory in this case was that if the developers conform to city regulations, they got to walk.
That struck me as odd.
Well, that struck me as odd too, Your Honor.
It strikes me as peculiar that you could just do whatever the city said, which, a given city may know something about water diversion and it may not know anything, and then you get a pass.
I agree with that, and I agree with that especially in this case, Your Honor. I believe the record reflects that our regulations don't increase the velocity and flow of water reaching downstream properties. We didn't say tell them how to do it. They were the ones that figured out how to do it. Their engineers bring us the plans that say this accomplishes that result. We check the math. We have our engineer look at it. But they get a walk.
What's the consequence if a city or governmental unit acquires a facility that was negligently designed, and the city doesn't know that, after the city acquires it, there's frequent recurrent flooding? What obligation, if any, do you have against the governmental unit when you know that if you can't continue to operate the way you're operating it, it's going to continue to flood someone's property frequently?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that question has been answered by a Texas case. I mean, obviously the test at Bragg is causing, and I want to answer the court's question, but I want to make sure that the court understands what theory this case was tried on. This case was tried on the theory that there was a defect in the design. There really isn't any evidence that someone said, city, you should fix this after you have acquired the right to maintain or operate the easement. We think the distinction in this case with respect to who has the liability is pointed out in the Phillips case out of the Washington Supreme Court cited in our brief, that you basically looked to what caused the act, what caused the damage. In this case, we say that the damage, which we can see there probably was a result of not what we did, but the design.
I confess I have not read all the reread some of the cases, but it seems that there was a case, an older case, where I think it was the Brazos River, or river started flooding a facility, and once it became apparent that it was going to be a recurrent event, then there was some sort of taking issue.
Well, Your Honor, obviously that's the issue to a certain extent that was decided in Bragg.
Not really. I mean, well, you used the word is in the test, but the complaint in Gregg was you built it this way knowing this was going to happen. And you even went out and got flood easements along the way in contemplation of that. So they might have made an argument. Well, now, even if you didn't know it then, you know it now that it's flooding. But it's not clear that that's the case.
And I appreciate the court's comment to Greg, because I'll have to admit the recurrence analysis has given me some pause. I don't think you can read Greg as the court says. I appreciate the court's comment that Greg was basically a result or inevitable consequence, as the court said, of the intended design of the dam.
Well, the recurrence goes to both issues. It goes to, is it really inevitable? If it just happens, if after the fact of construction, it just happens one time, you think, well, maybe this is going to keep happening or not. But if it keeps happening, then you pretty well know this is a problem. Again, as Justice Owen is asking, does it matter here that the city now owns an easement that's causing flooding?
Under the theory in which this case was tried, Your Honor, I do not believe that it makes a difference, because again, they're saying you shouldn't have approved this drainage plan because you knew that the development caused the ground to lose its absorbency. And by virtue of that fact, you should have known if you approved this plan, we would be flooding.
You cite the Ford case, Fifth Circuit case, that the city's conduct must be evaluated on the knowledge the city had at the time it approved the developer's drainage plan. I take it that's the only case that you know that says that.
Well, with that specific holding, Your Honor, but with respect to the logic of the situation, the theory of the case here is that you knew this plan was going to cause the damage, not that once you took over maintenance of the easement, that some act by the city then caused damage. So if you accept the theory of this case, that's why we say that certainly the pivotal moment in time is the time of the improvement.
So we're writing the law with a broader view, not just this case. What if the city had acquired, a developer had built a sewer system, and the city acquired it, and it backed up once and flooded a specific house? And then over time, it became apparent that every time that the water got to a certain level, the sewage system was going to back up and put sewage in a specific house. At what point is there a taking, if there is?
Well, again, Your Honor, I suppose you have to go back to the first prong of the Jennings test. Knows that a specific act is causing identifiable harm. I suppose that if you tried a theory, if you tried a case on the theory of maintenance or something such as that, then you would basically apply that test. When did you know that a specific act is causing identifiable harm? Once that work, i.e. the sewage system, became a public work, we don't agree that anything that damaged the Wilsons in this case constituted a public work because of the theory that put it was tried.
But the city could do something about it. Obviously, one thing you could do, you could condemn and extend the drainage as in accordance with the 91 plan.
I suppose, yes, Your Honor, that's theoretically possible.
Could you make the developers at this point do something about it?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
What is there about the current, the plan at the time of approval that negated the 91 plan?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's the Court of Appeals theory. The inference that they drew was based on two facts. One, that the ground lost its absorbency when it was developed. And two, that the 90 or 91 plan had this channel across the Wilson. From that, I think they draw this conclusion. One, you knew there was going to be an increase in the velocity and flow of water. Two, you must have included that ditch channel across the Wilson to protect the Wilsons from that increased flow. Three, the conclusion being, you knew not by not building the channel that there would be an increase in flow. Under the state of the record in this case is, Your Honor, we have regulation that says don't increase the velocity and flow. And that's not an empty formality under the record of this case. The record shows that everyone tried to conform to that regulation.
Right. But you're saying what you knew later at the time of approval conclusively outweighed all of those inferences we would normally make in favor of the person that wanted to try. What is there about the new knowledge at the time of approval that conclusively wiped out what you previously?
All right. I don't understand. Well, I think the Court of Appeals inference is based on a conclusion that the only way to protect the Wilsons is to dig that ditch. But the record doesn't show that. The record shows that we were told by the developers that the detention basins that were part of their plan were sufficient to keep the velocity and flow of the water at a point it was prior to development. So, if you accept the fact that our plan, the developer's plan, is as good as was envisioned by the 91 plan, then I don't think you can reach the conclusion that we knew a specific act was causing identifiable harm or knows that the specific property damage is substantially certain to result from an authorized government act.
Was there any flooding before the city accepted the easement?
Was there any flooding across the Wilson property? Yes, ma'am. I believe there was.
So by the time you accepted the easement, you did know there was flooding and you did know that the developer's plan wasn't working?
No, ma'am. I misunderstood your question. I thought you meant, was there flooding that predated development?
No, was there flooding that predated the city's acceptance of the drainage easement?
Was there flooding in association with some aspect of development?
Yes. That's,
I don't believe the record indicates that, Your Honor.
You say in your briefs that the Wilson's expert testified that the 1990 plan could be modified, and I think the Court of Appeals opinion said, however, that the city's people said that the plan had not ever been modified.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the record. I believe what the plaintiffs were relying, the respondents were relying upon is a statement by the then director of Public Works that there were no quote-unquote exceptions to the plan. But I also believe that the record indicates that the plan was a means of how the city was thought water should be moved in accord with its historic path. There was testimony that the plan could be altered. There was testimony by the expert retained by the city that he thought that the change to the plan, or the implementation of the developer's drainage plan, as opposed to digging the ditch, did not negligently impact the Wilsons, because again, it accomplished what the goal was of not increasing the velocity and flow of the water reaching the Wilsons.
But you now, you can see now, we all know that that's not, didn't turn out to be the case.
That is apparently correct, but again, if the intent standard set out in Jennings is going to have some meaning, I don't think, especially in this case, you can create a presumption that because there was damage, we can infer intent. We have to look at the intent, especially in this case, at the time the city made the decision for which plaintiffs are trying to hold them liable.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Casey will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, in answer to Justice's question concerning the developers, we did sue the developers for violation of 1186, as well as the trespass, the theory of trespass. The developers filed motions for summary judgment in the trial court under the theory that they were following the instructions and regulations of the city, and therefore they should not be held liable for any damage which may have resulted under water impacting or flowing upon the Wilson's property. The trial court granted the motions for summary judgment. The Wilson went to trial only against the city of Keller under the inverse condemnation theory. The city of Keller sued the developers for contribution and indemnification under their developers agreement. At the conclusion of the evidence, the court directed a verdict on behalf of the developers against the city of Keller. In other words, the court basically found that the developers were not liable under the contribution indemnification of the developers agreement in existence at the time to the city. Therefore, the only issues that were presented to the jury, or the only parties that were presented to the juries at the time of the conclusion of the trial, left were the Wilsons, the plaintiffs, and the city of Keller under both the inverse condemnation theory, which is jury question number 8 and 9, and under the 11.086 water code theory, which I believe was
question. And you're not complaining about the summary judgment?
No, sir. I took that up on appeal to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals addressed it. While I felt it was not right, I thought it was my energy would be better voiced by directing my attention to the city's position than bringing up this as a side issue. You're right, Your Honor. We did not bring that up on appeal.
Is the developer's agreement part of the record?
Yes, ma'am. It was part of the Now, this is the developer's agreement between the developers and the city.
And the city.
The city's introduced a developer's agreement because they were suing for under the developer's agreement for contribution and indemnification.
And what does the developer's agreement say in terms of who's got responsibility for what?
I do not know, Your Honor, to be honest with you. My theory against the developers was the water code theory and trespass. I was not a party to the contract, and so therefore I don't have and did not study that contract. The city of Keller may be able to address that issue with a lot more clarity than I can.
Okay.
I hope I answered your question.
Well, it just strikes me that
Yes. You've
got people whose property's damaged, and they strikes me they should be entitled to recover for it. They're pointing at the developers and the city, and the developers and the city are doing
this. Yes, ma'am. The developers' theory was somewhat similar, I believe, to the defense plants theory. We build the plane in accordance with the government specifications, and therefore we're not liable if the plane goes down. That was, in essence, what their theory of, as to why there was a break. And I think the Court of Appeals held that there was a break in causal connection and found that the city was liable for this particular situation. I would like to address a couple of things specifically. First is, in the city's brief on page 29, note 9, the city concedes that the city contributed $11,050 as participation in the drainage project because the developer oversized the permanent drainage easement to accommodate the ultimate drainage needs according to the 1990 plan. This, in essence, was also testified by Mr. Barnes, who was the Director of Public Works at the time and one of the engineers, in his testimony, which is in Volume 4, page 41, where I interrogated him regarding Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 29, which is part of the developer's agreement. We go back to before this, when this began. These two developments, it's in essence, you have to stack property. The Wilsons are at the bottom. The Sebastian property is next.
We're generally familiar.
I'm sorry.
Let me ask you, can we ignore the fact that when this was finally approved, that three sets of engineers told the city this is going to be fine? Can't ignore that, even though we're here on a no evidence review, can we?
Your Honor, what we have with a city, this is, to me, is like any other expert testimony. When you're going to look to the issue of intent and the city assurances, you almost have to look like a money quarterback going backwards in time, because the city is always going to say, we never intended to hurt anybody. The city assurances...
In a bad faith case, the plaintiff's always going to say, I have a good claim against the insurance company. But the insurance company is not required to take the first claim and pay all claims. They hire an investigator. Investigator tells them, if it's a third-party investigator, it's a good claim or it's a bad claim. And if they tell them it's a bad claim, then they're in good faith thereafter. Now,
yes,
why isn't this like that?
This, Your Honor, the city engineers, did they communicate that fact? I have no direct evidence that they did not. What I do have, Your Honor, and we think is in front of here, is that this is the opinion of the engineers, that this will not violate or will not do damage. And as any expert's opinion may be disregarded by a jury.
But must the city disregard it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I think, as with all experts, the city or anybody who receives an expert opinion takes it into advisement, and they have to decide whether or not to believe the expert opinion and act accordingly, to believe part of the expert opinion.
Is there any evidence in the record that would suggest that the engineer's assessment was inaccurate and that the city should have known that?
At the time that the assurance was given,
yes,
Your Honor?
Right.
No, sir.
Then why would the city have to test that engineer's opinion further than it did? Why couldn't it accept it as true and believe that they're not the experts on flooding, that the engineers are, and they say no flooding is going to happen?
I think
that'd be the end of it in terms of intent.
And as far as the intent, Your Honor, the intent issue I think the city engineers, the assurances of the city engineers, and I think when we go back to how and when you view the evidence of intent, if it is pre-construction, which is when the assurances were supposedly given, or do you look at intent like all issues of intent, where you kind of almost have to look backwards after an event has happened to see whether or not intent was or was not a factor at the time of the event. And with the assurances by the city, or the assurances given to the city by the engineers, did that constitute a bad faith intent? I don't think it constituted a bad faith intent. I just think that it is an opinion issued by an expert which may be disregarded by a jury at the time of the trial.
Have you looked at the Gregg case? For example, let's suppose that the evidence in the Gregg case had been, and I'm not sure that I recall exactly what it was, but all the engineers had told the water district in that case that this dam will not cause downstream flooding. And then after the dam was built, it turns out they were wrong, and it caused downstream flooding. What would that be a taking?
I believe, Your Honor, that if there would be a taking and there will also be damages. I think the court found in Gregg that there was adverse condemnation, if I remember the case, it just came out this year. In this situation, Your Honor, we had the developments came across the permanent drainage easement, which was owned by the city. The water was, this was a permanent drainage easement. It was 65 feet in width, 4 to 5 feet deep. There was a concrete placement, what they call a weir, at the easement so as to funnel the water off these developments and additional water down through the easement so that it would outcrop onto the Wilson's property. Prior to the development, the development property was just raw land. And so the water, while it did come onto the Wilson's property, it came through a gully. That is why we had Dr. Spindler testify as to the difference between the water coming onto the Wilson's property pre-construction and the water coming onto the Wilson's property after the development of the two developments, so that the jury could see a difference. Because I couldn't come up and say, well, we didn't have water before, because there was water coming across the property, and that's why we had
you
the
clearly
water.
Make the claim that the structure of this easement and drainage was done in such a way that it floods your property. The court has asked this morning the city of Keller, is there also a claim in the case that by virtue of the city's ownership of this easement now and its current contribution to flooding on the plaintiff's property, is that claim in the case that that's a taking? And the city of Keller says no. They say that's not part of your claim. Your claim is that you set this up in such a way that it constitutes a taking, not that its current existence is a taking.
Your Honor, I think there's almost a continual taking. I recognize that may be kind of a strange thing to say, but they constructed this, water comes, and it comes onto the property. Water still comes. It still rains. Water is still there, so it's almost an ongoing.
But did you present evidence at trial that the city had some duty to do something?
There was not a duty in the sense of a negligence, because that would be subject to a defense of governmental immunity. There was a duty not to injure, which would be similar under 11086. But
was there any evidence that the city intentionally did or failed to do anything after the flooding began, after development?
I think the evidence, Your Honor, that the city did nothing after it began was just been the city's attitude throughout the case. I mean, it has done absolutely nothing after.
But you didn't present evidence that they should have done anything other than they should have bought the easement on your client's property.
We presented, I don't know whether you presented evidence, we made an argument, Your Honor, in summation. that the city could have eminently domained my client's case or client's property. The city could have approached the Wilsons about either voluntarily giving them an easement or to volunteer or to sell them an easement so that they could carry out the master drainage plan. The evidence also showed that the city put in the box culvert at the south end of the Wilson's property so the water coming off the Wilson's property could exit into Little Bear Creek. I think the Court of Appeals drew the inference that maybe the city felt that they could not ask the developers, after they'd already asked the developers to buy the Sebastian's easement and to build the easement, to now go to the Wilson's and do that. We couldn't compel them to do eminent domain. I mean, their attitude throughout the entire case has been, we did nothing wrong. We either relied upon the assurances of the city engineers or we did not intend to hurt you in any form or fashion.
Let me ask a little different way. If you had had an engineer yourself at the time, and everybody was consulting with you about what's the best way to do this, and your engineer agreed with everybody else, these retention ponds will fix it, this plan is a good one, it's not going to flood. And it turns out everybody was wrong. But they are wrong because it is flooding. Would you still have a taking in that situation?
And that's it. If I understand the question, and let me see if I can give it back to you to make sure that I understand. If the Wilsons had hired an engineer to also review the plans as presented by the developers to the city, the Wilsons engineer reviewed the plans, found that they were sufficient. And then I think at that point, one of two things, either we would have signed off on an easement, in which event we would have lost any right of condemnation because there would have been...
No, you don't. Everybody says you don't need an easement on the Wilson's property. And the Wilsons agree.
Your theory is we just basically rubber stamped the plans, but we took no affirmative action of granting an easement. The city right. didn't do anything. We just basically said, well, it looks fine to us. Go ahead. In that situation, Your Honor, I think I would probably pursue my engineer first. I would probably also.
I'm trying to get at whether it makes any difference that the city did not know at the time the work was undertaken that this was going to happen, if in the end it actually did happen.
The city did not know at the time it was going to happen, but if it does, isn't that what happens in most cases? You think something is not going to happen and it ends up happening? And that's why I was saying that it's always kind of a Monday morning quarterbacking, because you're going back and looking at what led up to the event. And that's what the jury did in this case, in all cases, is that they look at what the evidence was presented, and they, in essence, look backwards in time to see whether or not the evidence fits or matters to the questions that are presented.
Maybe that's what happens in negligence cases, that what you expect to happen doesn't happen. But when we're looking at intent, at least as underlies the question, at the time the transaction was agreed to, that's a different issue, isn't it?
Well, if you look at the intent at the time, there's always going to be, as the Court of Appeals stated, there's always going to be a protestation by the person who is sued. I never intended anything bad to happen. But then I don't know how you... Otherwise, how are you ever going to, short of an admission by a party, that, yes, I intended to do this act. I intend to hurt that person.
Yes, intent is a high hurdle. It's intended to be a high hurdle. But it has to be proven in order to get to damages in your case. Certainly negligence can occur if you expect something to happen on day one, but on day three something different happens that you didn't expect. You can go back and test to see if folks stepped out of line, made mistakes, errors in judgment. You can do that here too, but the question is a different one. Did they intend, was there substantial certainty that a result was going to occur? That's a different inquiry than the negligence inquiry, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, addressed the substantial certainty issue. The other thing that also, in this case, Your Honor, and that is the jury question number 8 doesn't talk about substantial certainty. This was the city's jury question as to intent. And it said, you know, did the city intentionally perform act which caused damage to the Wilson's property? So that's the prism almost that you have to look through this no evidence or legal sufficiency evidence argument as opposed to the substantial certainty argument. I am appreciative of the Court of Appeals in addressing the substantial certainty argument in their opinion, but I think they could have basically said we look at it through the vision and the prism as set forth in the issue which was submitted to the jury, which was a different issue than the substantial certainty issue as presented in the Tarrant Regional Water Drag decision and the, I think, the City of Dallas versus Jennings case.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
The city had a drainage plan. It didn't have to. Would it make any difference to your case if it didn't?
If it didn't have a drainage plan, I think it would make a difference, sir, because this was the plan is almost the standard as to which the jury could judge the actions of the city.
A city that just doesn't care very much,
no,
they wouldn't be taking anything, but a city that's out there being diligent, they're in more danger of having to take it.
No, sir, I'm not, didn't mean it that way. When the city has a plan and the plan says that the water, in the Wilson's case, that the water is going to come across the Wilson's property diagonally, we intend for the water to come across there. That's the way the plan shows it's going to come. They knew the water was going to come in this situation. I think when they have a plan, it does assist a jury or any fact finder in determining whether or not they have complied with the plan, which also brings into an issue as to whether the plan is or is not adequate. If, however, they did not have a plan and just said, we're just going to let the water flow willy-nilly, then I think what you get to is the public use issue as to did the city derive a public use or a public benefit out of the developments that permitted the water to proceed.
Well, let me follow up on that real quickly. If we were Washington, and I know that the city has cited on page 32 and 33 of its brief a couple of cases out of the Washington court, and the one of the quotes from that case struck me. It says, the fact that a county regulates development and requires compliance with road and drainage restrictions does not transform a private development into a public project. If we were Washington, would you lose under those two cases, Pepper and Phillips?
I think if I remember the Phillips case, I think there was a third. There was the three conditions, and I think we would have felt under the third issue. To address what I believe is your question about a development being a public work, I think in a development there is to a certain degree all public works because the streets are given an easement to the city under the plat, and in this situation the public work was the easement which was owned by the city where the water drained down and which the city required to have been purchased and granted to the city by the developers in this case?
Well, again, we get into the point in time analysis.
Yes, ma'am.
If the point in time we're looking at is approval of the plat, the city did not own it then. And just, I think the argument is, and I think we'd probably all agree, we don't want to hold cities liable just for approving developers' plans. And if that's the point of time we look at, it would seem that this case would apply. Whereas when they took over ownership, and if the damage was continuing at that point and substantially certain to continue, that would be a taking at that point in time.
I think, Your Honor, if I may, that I believe the approval was contingent, though, upon the city, upon the developers purchasing the Sebastian easement and acquiring the easement for the benefit of the city, and that was part of the approval process. I thank the court for its consideration.
Thank you.
I certainly agree with Justice Jefferson that even if these engineers were wrong, so they may well have been under this record.
Well, let's explore that. In our North, I don't know if it's Northbrook or North Glen case, some authority was widening an access road.
Yes, ma'am.
And suppose that it presented a safety issue and also it became so close to an office building that caused a sort of a fear factor of the people in the building. What if would it be a defense to a taking if the authority, TxDOT or whoever it was widening the road, all of its engineers said, this isn't a problem. Don't worry about it. This is not a safety issue. This is not an access issue. They had five different engineers sign off. Is that going to be a defense to a taking when, in fact, the city intended to build the road and it did have those consequences?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be a defense. Because if you look at
the So the city can build the road wherever they want without regard to the consequences, as long as they get engineers to say it's not going to have any adverse impact.
Your Honor, Jennings says you know that a specific act is causing identifiable harm.
Well, it is causing in this case. I mean, that's the point, the nub of it.
I understand, Your Honor.
When do you judge this? I mean, for takings purposes.
The specific act is causing identifiable harm in this case is the approval of the plan. So if you take the snapshot at that point in time, then yes, I think the engineer's approval is a defense. Now, does the city get to, or does a condemning authority, I think what the respondents in Bragg are talking about, the head in the sand approach, could a condemning authority consciously ignore what an obvious risk? No, but that's not what happened in this case, Your Honor. What happened in this case is we had three sets of engineers say.
Well, same question. Let's suppose they're building the city decides to build a toll road through a residential area, and all the experts say, well, with this respect to these two pieces of property, the decibel level is going to be just like everybody else's, and it's not going to be appreciably different. But when it turns out, as built, that's not the case, and the decibel level is off the charts. Is the city going to say, well, you know, we in good faith relied on these engineers' report, and so even though it is a taking, physical invasion, we're not liable for a taking?
Your Honor, I think under those circumstances, we have to, from Weber to down to Gragg to Jennings, this court's trying to figure out how we cut this cake.
But you intended for water. You intended for water to flow across the Wilson's property. Nobody differs about that.
We knew that water would flow across, as it historically had flown across.
And you're saying we didn't know it would that the volume would be what it is. But you did intend a physical invasion.
Your Honor, we knew that the water would continue to flow. If you mean did we intend a physical invasion by increasing the velocity and flow of the water? No. Did we intend a physical invasion by virtue of the fact that we knew that water would continue to flow across the Wilson's property as it has historically flowed across the Wilson's property? Then the answer is yes.
Let me ask you, if instead of three engineers telling you it was okay, what if one said, nope, you're going to need to drainage easement, and two said, no, you won't?
Probably a fact question.
Then it's up to the jury. And so how is this case different since instead of one person at the time, it was one plan 4 years earlier?
Your Honor, again, I think that the inference that the Court of Appeals draws is that the only way to protect the Wilsons was to dig this ditch as envisioned by the 1990 plan. I don't think you can draw that inference from this record.
One of the things that strikes me is it seems that the first question we might have to address is the water code violation, because that would be an alternative finding that would support the trial court's judgment. I mean,
yes,
I presume the measure of damages is the same under
both. Well, there are separate damage issues submitted with respect to the water code violation.
But you know, out of 50 pages of briefing, we only have like 3 pages on that. Was there any sort of dispositive motion filed with the trial court or urged on the water code violation claim?
No, ma'am. I think the matter of the briefing is a result of the fact that the Court of Appeals simply didn't reach that issue. They said we pass over this issue because we think the inverse condemnation issue is dispositive.
So if we were to rule your way on the condemnation point, would we need to remand it to the Court of Appeals to deal with the water code issue?
I think so. I appreciate the Court's time. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the argument. The Court will now take a brief recess.